It's been a little over a week since a Surfside condo building partially collapsed in the middle of the night. The search for survivors continues as eyes turn to the tropics to follow Hurricane Elsa, which now threatens the peninsula. This is the South Florida Roundup. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. What could the storm mean for Surfside rescue efforts? How is the county preparing for a potential hurricane as the pandemic continues? And condominiums are part of the culture in South Florida. Thousands of people live in them. How are those buildings administered? How do homeowner associations work? Could that all change after the tragedy in Surfside? And then we'll hear from journalists who have been covering the disaster. The South Florida Roundup is made possible by Willie the Bee-Man, bee removal specialist. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Tom Hudson. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. For more than a week, first responders have been searching for survivors in the rubble of the Champlain Towers South. World-renowned research and rescue teams have been deployed to the area to help. They've worked through rainstorms and persistent heat. They've been delayed by fears that the remaining structure of the condo building could topple. And now Hurricane Elsa presents another potential threat. How is the county preparing for the possibility of two emergencies happening at the same time? What are your questions about the ongoing search and rescue efforts in Surfside? Join the conversation by calling us now at 800-743-9576. That number is 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us. We're at WLRN. Joining us now is Charles Searle. He's the Miami-Dade County's Deputy Incident Commander for Surfside. And welcome to the program, Charles.
Good afternoon, Mr. Rivero. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. First of all, if you could just give us an update on the latest from the site of the condo collapse, what's the most pressing concern for first responders at this point?
Well, currently, it's been quite a challenge. We've had quite a few factors that we had to consider. We've brought in appropriate subject matter experts to contemplate, you know, the search and rescue and the assistance of our victims and survivors, and we're continuing that search. The challenges, of course, have been the weather. I think you stated that in your opening. The transitions maybe the heat that, you know, the South Florida heat, which, you know, of course we're accustomed to, but then the rain, the constant rain and the lightning, which causes us obviously to have to cease operations for the safety of our personnel. But all to that, we understand that we have quite a few professional teams, experienced teams throughout the state of Florida, and now we've supplemented that with our federal partners. And of course, I'd be remiss if I did not mention the international partners that we've that have joined our search and rescue operations. So the factors being the weather, obviously, is a contributing factor, and could be made makes the operations a little bit difficult. But of course, again, the specter of a building which is partially collapsed and is an unsafe structure. And so we're determining and they are continually factoring the safety of their personnel. They have instruments on hand to monitor the building and any shifts or movement. And we continue to monitor those as we continue our search and rescue operations.
And the death toll as it is now when we're speaking is officially at 20 with about 130 people. I believe it's 128 still unaccounted for. We're more than a week out now from the incident itself. What's the outlook looking like now for the potential of finding more survivors at this point?
Yes, I have to say that currently we're still committed to search and rescue operations. And we will continue to do so. As we consult on a daily basis, twice a day basis, as we consult with our subject matter experts, we continue to search our search and rescue operations, and we're solely committed to that. So, at the conclusion of each day, we're looking at factors, and we're submitting, our opinions and having a roundtable to discuss what's the most appropriate course of action moving forward. And right now, that course of action has been unanimously search and rescue.
And the rescue efforts did take a pause for about 15 hours yesterday, and then they restarted. What was it that happened to allow the first responders to resume their search and rescue efforts?
Yeah, so the primary, as I mentioned previously, we have quite a few detection devices that are monitoring the movement and the stability of the partially, you know, the remaining structure. That a certain amount of movement that was detected precipitated a cease in operations until further assessment was done. The subject matter experts determined that it wasn't actually the structure that was moving, but the debris. Some of that debris triggered the slight movement, the vibrations. And so once that was determined that that was the factor and not exactly the structure, it was determined that search and rescue operations could resume. It's unfortunate that it occurred, but you know, the safety of our personnel is also a key factor and one of our key objectives as we continue this operation.
Of course. And we did just hear news that the daughter of a City of Miami firefighter was found last night. And that speaks to how personally taxing and how personally affected first responders might be in this. And I'm wondering, what kind of mental health supports or resources are being made available to those first responders that are on site?
Yes, thank you for asking. You know, it was said a few times by some of the elected officials that spoke, you know, a lot of people are maybe once removed from the individuals, you know, that lived in that building or even personally connected to that. And a lot of people here have that case. We have, and even if it wasn't that type of close relationship, for these types of events and any type of activation, we do have crisis counselors on hand. We've actually even mobilized additional throughout the state to support what we currently deploy on a normal operation. But realize we have about 7, well, now 10 task forces here with quite a few personnel, and that will require a large mobilization of crisis counselors. We thank that we have some, thankfully. Miami-Dade County has a lot of resources, and we are able to mobilize those that can serve a lot of the personnel that are here. But thankfully, in partnership with the state, we were able to mobilize, and the federal government. I can't forget FEMA's assistance.
And I've seen trucks coming in yesterday from Virginia. So, I saw them on
the
highway.
Yes, that's quite right. And so we have quite a few more resources as we discussed ELSA at the onset is making its way towards Florida. We have to be able to rest our other personnel in the state so that they may be able to respond to ELSA if it makes landfall in the state. So yes, it's two factors, and I'm glad you brought that up. There's two factors: it's the rest and it's that counseling. And so we need to be able to rotate other personnel in so that those other individuals can rest and take in the overall, you know, the overwhelming incident that we're undertaking here and responding to. And so they need that kind of rest and someone to speak to. And as I said, the state, the county, other municipalities and the federal government have mobilized crisis counselors to assist those that are responding to this incident.
And Charles, you did mention Hurricane Elsa. We'll get to that in a moment. But for now, I want to bring in Ryan Gabner into the conversation. He's the paramedic program director at Broward College and the battalion chief for Lauderhill Fire Rescue. Ryan, thanks for coming on. And what do you tell your students about how to mentally and emotionally prepare to respond to a disaster incident like this?
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me on the show. And this isn't just something that we train our students to do. This is something that even in my role as a battalion chief, that I am constantly training veterans, 20, 30 year veterans, on the mental health aspect, on what we need to look out for to help each other out. So to go back to your original question with students, I tell them from the get-go, this isn't a now mentality. This is a career-long pursuit on health and wellness for ourselves. Because if we can't protect ourselves, we can't protect our partners, we can't protect each other, how are we going to protect the public that we're sworn to serve and sworn to protect and to put out a product to help save these individuals? So I tell them it's not the now, it's the future we got to look for. So what we do now, what we embed into ourselves now when we're a young age, training, is what's going to be the biggest aspect later on. Not just physically, emotionally, but also spiritually and physically, emotionally, and spiritually sound together, because they all interlinked with each other.
I'm Danny Rivero. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're talking about emergency response procedures for tragedies like the Surfside condo collapse and how first responders protect themselves in these kind of situations. Do you have a message of support for emergency workers at the Surfside site? You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. And you can also tweet us at WLRN. President Biden was here yesterday, and he specifically mentioned his concerns for first responders' mental health. Here's what he had to say.
When I talked to those first responders, I pointed out that they're under a great deal of stress, and they should take advantage of the mental health facilities that are going to be available. Because, you know, we talk about our military suffering from post-traumatic stress. Well, seeing what they're seeing, doing what they're doing, understanding how much trauma is involved, I just don't want them thinking that they should walk away from help if it's needed.
Ryan, when with your students, how do you teach them to look out for signs that they might need help and that they're to make sure they're not just pushing these things off?
Yes, that's a great question, because it's easy when you read about it in black and white text, but it's the emotional aspect of it. It's the life experience is where you learn about these little clues. And in my role as a battalion chief, and even as an instructor, I tell my students and I tell my firefighters, both guys and gals, like, when someone gives you a little clue, you got to run with that. You can't just shrug it off, because I've had friends who've had issues. I've had personal friends who have had other friends who have committed suicide. And they've told me, hey, I wish I could have done this. I wish I could have done that. I wish I could have reached out a little more.
So other first responders?
I always tell my, for first responders, yes. And over the years, like we talked about this pandemic, there is a pandemic in first responders, both police officers and firefighters, where suicide has outranked the line of duty deaths over the past few years. So I always tell my students, if someone gives you a little clue, if you see something that's not right, you need to act upon it. You need to try and get into it, because the whole mentality of the firefighter egos that we could control everything within ourselves, that's not true anymore. In fact, we encourage quite the opposite, to go out and speak, to go out and talk to a therapist, to go out and seek professional help, well, whatever it is, because we know the long-term effects and what it could do mentally to us.
I want to turn now back to Charles. Charles, you mentioned Hurricane Elsa, which is strengthening right now in the Caribbean. It could be here in Florida as soon as Sunday, so on Independence Day, 4th of July. It's too soon to know whether it will arrive here, what the impacts will be. But considering that is a prospect that could happen, how are first responders on the scene right now in Surfside preparing for the arrival of a hurricane in the middle of these rescue efforts?
Thank you for asking that question. Part of our operations is always to contemplate transition and or demobilization. As this event obviously occurred in the midst of hurricane season, we had to consider that factor as we set up a mini village here in Surfside. Those plans have been contemplated, and we are factoring how to continue our key objective, which is search and rescue, while maintaining a transition of the safety of this village. So those things are happening behind the scenes with other personnel involved to ensure that those that are tasked with the search and rescue operation are not taken away from that duty to worry about the demobilization piece if and when it becomes necessary. So we have now embedded our weather service with us in our planning and other subject matter experts to discuss when is the key time to contemplate, or what are the keys for us to the triggers for us to make a move. But all in the meantime, ensuring that the personnel that are tasked with the search and rescue operation can continue that seamlessly, whether their base be right here in the village as when we started this operation, or maybe a few miles away.
And with this active search and rescue operation happening, there are very large amounts of debris on site, and the structure that is remaining, we do know that there has been some concern about whether that could collapse. If a hurricane does come here or come very close to here, is there any plan to ask the surrounding residents to maybe move or shift operations away from that site in some way?
Yes, we are monitoring, obviously, the situation. And, as you mentioned in the opening, there's a lot of uncertainty with ELSA and its potential impacts here. Engineers are studying, tolerance of the building to sustained winds. Of course, we are contemplating that. We have looked at a collapse field. And we've measured that, and we've factored that in. Fortunately, at the onset of this incident, the buildings adjacent to the Champlain Tower were evacuated, and even some were voluntarily evacuated. And so we think we have an appropriate debris field, and depending on strength and track of the storm, that may be expanded as necessary. But we are taking all those factors into consideration as we contemplate our planning for ELSA and as it approaches South Florida.
And in normal times, hurricanes is a big part of what your office handles. What are the preparations that are happening, not just at the Surfside site, but for other parts of Miami-Dade County, if you could tell us briefly?
Yes, absolutely. Thankfully, many residents of South Florida are, I hope, hurricane savvy. I hope our office has done a lot in the preparedness and proliferating that message. In the background, our EOC is quite active right now. If you were to go there, they are contemplating potential evacuation orders. They are mobilizing and contacting our special needs clients and identifying the appropriate evacuation centers if necessary. To operate and open. We're also mobilizing additional personnel as necessary, or putting them on alert and standby as appropriate to respond to ELSA if the track changes immensely, and or whatever actions are necessary to precipitate additional protective actions. We are constant contact. I know our mayor is here, and I'm here by her side to ensure that she's aware of all protective recommendations that may become necessary, from one advisory to the next, and she's informed and able to provide decisions based on the recommendations that we provide her.
We've been speaking with Charles Searle, the Miami-Dade County Deputy Incident Commander for the Surfside site, and also Ryan Gabner, the Broward College Paramedic Program Director and Battalion Chief for Lauderhill Fire Rescue. Charles and Ryan, thank you so much for taking time out of your days to come talk with us.
Thank you. Great pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, a dive into the inner workings of homeowners associations and the role they play in property maintenance. Are you living in a condo? Have you lived in one before? What was it like navigating the politics of the building? You can join the conversation by calling 800-743-WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Tom Hudson this week. Millions of Floridians live in condos. It's part of the culture of this place. So the partial collapse of the Champlain Tower South and Surfside has a lot of people here asking questions about the safety of their own buildings and what power they have to protect their homes and their families. So what role do homeowner associations play in all this? And when repairs are needed to get done, how do those costs get spread around? This segment, we're going to dig into all things HOA. Join the conversation here on WLRN. Are you a condo owner? Do you rent one? What experiences have you had dealing with condo boards and HOAs? Do you work as a property manager? Call us now at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also share your thoughts with us on Twitter at WLRN. Joining us now is Gary Mars, an attorney with Siegfried Rivera Law Firm in Coral Gables. And he's also a specialist in community association law. And also joining us is Lisa Moses, the president of Peninsula Condominium Association at a waterfront condo building in Aventura that was built in 2003. Gary and Lisa, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Danny. Thank you for having us.
Hi, Danny.
Hi, Lisa. So, Lisa, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your building? What kind of challenges have you had to tackle as the head of your condo association, specifically when it comes to repairs?
So we had to deal with, we just finished a 3.5 year construction renovation project throughout the entire community. We're two towers, 446 units total. We have 13 acres of property. And so there is a lot of maintenance that comes with that. There was our tower was built in 2003. The sister tower was built in 2008. And with that came construction defects from the developer, which went into litigation. And it was settled. It took many years to settle. And upon settlement, we immediately started the process to begin repair, because in the time that you go through the litigation, it actually, things continue to degrade, or you know, you just need to validate that that is what actually needs to be repaired. So
but the longer you put things off, the worse they get, or the problems accelerate.
100%. So, but we just completed. The community's been in construction for 3 years. So. But there was about a year and a half of planning that went into it with engineering firms prior to the actual start of construction.
And I'm curious, since the Surfside collapse happened, how have conversations with fellow residents about some of these moves that you and the association have made, or things that you've talked about, how have those conversations been taking place over the last week? Have they changed at all?
They, of course. I mean, Champlain was a devastating occurrence. We all watched. It's all 6 degrees of separation for Champlain. We are just a few miles from there. And many residents, of course, is our tower safe? But fortunately, residents also know that we underwent significant structural repairs in a building that was only, at the time when we started, 15 years old. So we made sure to get in front of it instead of, you know, we were proactive versus reactive on it.
And on that note, how were you made aware that there were structural issues? Did you guys have an inspector come in that
we
you
did.
Asked to come in?
We did. We absolutely did. We had multiple engineering firms come in and evaluate the property. That has to happen when you go into turnover litigation, which Gary will talk about, and I'm sure Eric can touch on. But we had multiple firms, and then we had additional firms come in after litigation concluded to validate and make sure that everything that needed to be fixed was fixed.
So, Gary, can you give us kind of a general overview of how condo associations work and tell us about some of the popular misconceptions people might have about them?
That's a very loaded question. So I'll try to back up. First, let me just say on behalf of myself and my firm that, you know, really our prayers and thoughts are with the victims and their families. I want to mention particularly because dear friends of ours, the Berezovic family, are going through very difficult times with this tragedy. So as Lisa said, you know, this has very much impacted, especially those in the North Dade area. It's, you know, we all know people that have been affected. So our thoughts are with them. That said, condominium associations, we got to remember they're a brilliant thought. We have resident owners that typically are running as volunteers these communities. There's all different sizes, shapes, and smells to all these properties. But what I think the a core value to all of them, and it's something that has been, you know, a repeated discussion that I've had over the course of the past week, is that the value of a volunteer board is as strong as the advisors that they rely upon. And that could be property managers, engineers, lawyers, accountants, a whole, you know, series of different individuals that really need to be tapped and utilized to assist them. So, you know, we understand that boards of directors are elected by the membership. They are serving under this duty that they have, which is, you know, referred to as the fiduciary duty, and it is their duty, that's how it's defined, to the membership to act in a reasonable and prudent manner and to best inform the community and function as the decision makers for the association. So in this context, that's, you know, where boards are challenged, because they have to make sometimes very significant and difficult decisions, like Lisa's board had to do, as to how to navigate through which, you know, very, very substantial projects. Many associations, the actual board members have never dealt with that, you know, on their own. This is the first time they've come across this level of decision making.
And Gary, when a condo association learns that there are repairs that need to be done, are there any obligations to make these repairs? And I ask the question because the you know, there's a well-known tension and stereotype, if you will, that some residents don't want to see repairs because there on some level is some distrust between what the money they pay for goes towards, if that's really necessary. There's a little bit of distrust here, but I just want to get at what are the obligations of the board once they are in that position.
So the answer is absolutely. An association's board has a duty to, you know, one of the key tenets to a board of directors is to ensure that the building is being properly maintained. So in the spirit of that, it's not just about 40-year recertification where a lot of attention has been directed. It's about the overall and regular evaluation of the building to determine what the requirements are. Many associations that I represent, you know, we are constantly dealing with damages and things of that nature, which occur in the teenage years or the maturing years of an association. So, you know, the duty of an association's board is to evaluate the building periodically, rely upon the association's property manager, which is a, you know, an agent of the board of directors and association, to, you know, provide information regularly, and then engage in certain cases engineers, typically in the case of building structure and things of that nature, to evaluate and direct the board as to how to proceed.
And what if people on a condo board want to put off repairs because of the high cost? Can residents of the building push back or vote out the board that tried to raise the association fees?
So the answer is yes. And we often see that. And I will tell you, one of the big dilemmas that I understood occurred at Champlain and occurs across the board, and we and my firm deal with it regularly, is the balance between the obligation to perform the repairs and the concept of how we're going to fund the repairs. And so one of the dilemmas that occurs is that I think there's a certain level of board decision making that says that we should find maybe the most efficient financial way of getting through this, but that may not line up necessarily with what the engineers are dictating. So it runs into a dilemma between, you know, what are the conditions that need to be addressed and what are the costs in doing that, and how do we reconcile that to our membership?
And I want to go to the phones right now. We have Enrique in Miami. Enrique, you're on.
Hi, how are you? I'll be as brief as possible. I'm a realtor for the last 18 years in the Sunny Isles area. I'm a parishioner in St. Joseph's, which is three blocks away from the right. building that collapsed. So my heart goes out to all the first responders, everybody that's working day and night over there, all the families involved. The terrible tragedy, and all of us, I think nobody ever wanted that to happen. But unfortunately, I think we're set up for failure all around Florida, all around South Florida at least. And the main reason for that, I think, is politics, money, and greed. And it starts from deregulation and all the building codes and the associations. Unfortunately, as it is right now, the associations are the ones in charge of everything that runs on the building. And we're sitting in real estate that it's priceless, and every time gets more and more expensive. So there's tons of interest and tons of people with bad intentions. And unfortunately, to be a board member, you don't need much, because you all have to do is volunteer and get a couple of votes, and all of a sudden you're in charge of everything. I just closed on a property that had been for 7 years now past due on the 40-year certification. They have several fines from the city. There's no financing available in the building. And guess what? The bottom line is the board has no intention of doing anything, because they've been buying out every single one of the units that come up in the market.
Got it. And thank you, Enrique. We really appreciate those thoughts. Lisa, I do want to ask you, have you ever been in a situation where there was resistance from the owners of the condos to repairs that needed to be done because of the cost? And if so, how did you handle it? How do you work with that when there is an out, if you will?
So with respect, there, construction isn't convenient, right? Whenever you have construction, you are inconveniencing the residents of the property. So there's the cost and there's the inconvenience, and both take place at the same time when you're doing these repairs. So boards have a duty to make sure that the building is safe. That is first and foremost. And so you have to make decisions to make sure that the building is safe. And what you do is it's required. You get multiple bids. You hire expert partners, vendors, engineering firms, restoration firms. You hire experts, which a board is not an expert in concrete restoration.
Right.
So you make the best decisions based on what the experts have to say. And the membership always, I've been a board member for many, many years, they always push back on cost and inconvenience. But at the end of the day, it is imperative that the building be fixed properly for life safety reasons. This is not superficial, right? Yes, they can push back if you want to change the landscape or you want to do something that is decor related. But when it comes to life safety, a board does not have to get a membership vote for construction repair. If it is not construction repair, let's say it's decor, then you go out for a membership vote and the membership speaks. But when it comes to repair, it's the fiduciary duty to make those repairs properly.
I'm Danny Rivero. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're talking about homeowners associations and how they work with the condo association president and an attorney who specializes in community association law. You can join our conversation too and share your experiences dealing with HOAs by calling us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. And you can tweet us at WLRN. Lisa, to your position, I talked this week with a property manager who's worked in buildings all over the coastline from basically Ball Harbor up to Hollywood. And she told me that she fears that the scrutiny coming to board members after the Surfside collapse will make it less likely that people will want to serve on these volunteer boards because it's so much responsibility. I wonder, do you have any thoughts on that?
It definitely is. And of course, everybody should. If you're getting on a board, you should evaluate that in advance. It's not about being on a board, should always be about being able to be a voice and be a representative of your community. It's not, there is some pseudo understanding of, you know, that there is some type of control, and it should never be like that. Boards act as representatives for their members. And I can understand why there would be fear amongst people to volunteer for this type of responsibility, because the board of Champlain, sadly, is, you know, in ways going to be held responsible for this. And as a board, you carry director and officer's insurance. Every board carries D&O insurance, but it doesn't change the fact that you're responsible. And so I do believe that it will be more difficult to get good board members on boards in light of what happened at Champlain. Yes.
And Gary, going back to you, what kind of questions have you been getting from your clients over the last week with this intensifying scrutiny over boards and how they work?
The range has been very wide, but you know, Lisa's made some good points. Maybe to build off of her comments, insurance is something that needs to be looked at. I will tell you, just like you know, boards make decisions on how to save money in their maintenance obligations, boards also make those similar decisions with regard to the amount of insurance they're taking out. So I would certainly say that a prudent board should be meeting with and discussing with their agent regularly. But now, particularly under this situation, you know, do we have the appropriate amount of insurance, directors and officers, but also with regard to our property insurance? Are we getting, do we have an updated appraisal of our building to cover, you know, a catastrophic event, you know, and there's other issues to be taken into consideration. I've also spoken a bit to them about, you know, there's the question, and I don't want to, you know, open up a whole Pandora's box on this, but, you know, this dilemma that we talked about between, you know, having to effectuate repairs and having the costs raised, the money raised to do that. You know, one of the things that's come up quite a bit is, you know, should there be maybe some sort of government-backed loans available to certain qualified associations that cannot, because of the state of their community, they just can't raise the capital in sometimes very, very expensive repairs, multi-million dollar repairs, and the community just doesn't have the wherewithal to take it on based upon the membership.
Right. So, and also, you know, in some instances, you might have people living in buildings that are on retirement on fixed income, and when they get a special assessment, they might just say, well, I can't possibly do that. So it's a tough spot to be in for a board, I imagine.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think that would be something in the, you know, in the spirit of my community of lawyers, you know, and what kind of legislation should be considered, maybe something along the lines of, you know, having certain loans, SBA loans or other types of government involved loans available for qualified associations is something to consider. So you take some of that discretion of and burden, you know, involving the burden of having to, you know, pick and choose what projects you have to deal with when it comes to structural repairs away from a board and give additional options to them so that these necessary repairs are going to be performed.
And Gary, you're talking about potential reforms. Are there any other kinds of potential reforms you might see potentially coming out of this tragedy?
Right. Again, a lot during the course of the week that I've discussed with you know, some of my peers on this, we certainly will probably be seeing some changes to the recertification process. I think it will probably be updated and maybe expanded to include other conditions that need to be addressed, possibly even the shortening of timeframes for when those recertifications will occur. But in that grand context, I also want to just point out, you know, buildings mature and they age and conditions exist at different levels. So it remains the obligations of these boards and of the association to evaluate conditions throughout the course. So I don't want to overly emphasize the 40-year recertification process, which is a very important snapshot looking at the association during that time frame. The associations also have these obligations prior to that. So if you're seeing a condition which I think is something we'll see with Champlain when this all gets unfolded, these conditions that existed over a period of time, and you're being informed by an engineer that these situations occur, the boards have to act. There has to be timeframes for them to act. There is only so much evaluation process that you can go through. Like any situation, you can get a second opinion, and some associations do that. But once you go through that process, the boards have to act and make critical decisions, sometimes difficult decisions, but critical decisions on how they're going to proceed. Sometimes they have to phase it out a certain way. I mean, there's different options available. But that seems to be one of the problems, is that boards get stuck. They get mired in this decision-making, trying to appease the community, but also maybe not directly resolving the issues that exist. And too much time goes by and conditions, you know, continue to to expand.
You can't kick the can down the road forever. We do have a caller here, Yvette in Miami. You're on. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Hi. Thank you. I live in a condo, which is 8 stories. It is self-managed. It's a 3-member board, which they do whatever they want to do. They hire a lot of unlicensed contractors, and certainly don't pull permits. I've seen them do structural work as far as balconies, which I've reported in the past, and most recent, just drilling. They don't even inform the people that live in this community, the owners, that work is being done. They do it secretly. I have hired legal in the past, counsel in the past, spent a substantial amount of money. I think it's time we get a local office in Miami where our complaints and somebody can actually follow up on these things. Because personally, in my opinion, and I live near the water, I live near Key Biscayne, I've seen so much illegal work done on this property, I think in the future we will have some problems. We don't have a management company that would assume liability. And like I said, and the board members, by the way, were never really voted for. Only one, I think, out of the three. To this date, we haven't had a meeting for 2 years.
Thank you, Yvette. Yes, Gary, if you want to respond to those concerns.
Just quickly, I mean, you've laid out a few different points, and I think they're all important. Number one, there is, you know, legal rights under the Condo Act for a board to be replaced if they're not functioning correctly. And I know, Yvette, you're talking specific issues, but I want to broaden that a bit to say that it is ultimately up to the membership to evaluate the performance of a board of directors. And if they're underperforming and they're doing things that are suspect, you do have the right to either vote them out through the course of an annual meeting or remove them through a majority vote of the ownership. And there are extreme situations where that has to happen. And at a certain point, the ownership end up owning these problems because they have to act. They have to ensure that the building's being properly operated.
Got it. Thank you, Gary. Yeah, sorry, we're running out of time. Lisa, I want to ask you one last thing before we have to take a break.
Sure.
Is your condo association considering any changes in response to Surfside?
No. I mean, we take the building repair and maintenance very, very seriously, consistently. So it is business as usual, because we've gone through the structural repairs. Our managers are exceptional. Our management team is exceptional. And we have engineering staff, and, you know, we run the business like a business, and it is absolutely taken care of. So for our particular community, that answer is no, but I do see
Thank you, Lisa. I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there.
My pleasure. No, my pleasure.
We've been talking with Gary Mars, an attorney with Siegfried Rivera, and also Lisa Moses, president of Peninsula Condominium Association in Aventura. Thank you both for coming on. Still to come, we'll hear from journalists that have been covering the Surfside condo collapse. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Tom Hudson's off this week. Experts are trying to navigate the logistical challenge of searching for survivors in the rubble of Champlain Tower South. Weather and concerns about the structural integrity of the remaining structure have complicated that process. And we've heard about some harrowing and heartbreaking moments. Miami-Dade County Fire Chief Alan Kaminsky said shortly after the collapse that search and rescue team heard a female voice calling to them, and unfortunately they couldn't get to her. Along with the first responders, journalists have been on the scene of the collapse in Surfside over the last week trying to get some answers. Joining us now to share their reporting are Joey Fletchers of the Miami Herald and Daniela Hernandez of the Wall Street Journal, two friends of mine. Thank you both for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks, Danny.
Thanks for having us.
Joey, you were one of the first Miami Herald reporters on the scene after the collapse. Can you share with us a little bit about how that scene has changed over the last week?
Well, when I got there around 3:30 Thursday morning, this would be last week Thursday, it was, I mean, I'd never seen so many first responders and vehicles gathered in one spot here in Miami. And I lived here for 8 years, and this was just a very kind of unprecedented visual for me in the middle of the night, and with lots of questions. And there was a very limited information, and even to this day, right, no clear understanding of what led to this collapse. And so and there was an air and a feeling of you know, this was going to be bad, and this was going to be very, very bad. Firefighters walking off of the scene kind of talking amongst themselves about how they did not expect very many survivors, if any, after the folks that they had helped down from the building, a part of the building that continues to stand today. Since then, it's become this methodical, you know, deliberate and slow moving process, and slow moving for good reasons, right? Right. Process to peel back these layers, to delayer, as they say, this pile of debris and the floors that collapsed onto each other, hoping, praying that they find someone who's alive. And it's been hampered by weather, by spot fires, and by even the instability of the portion of the building that still stands. That yesterday there was a temporary work stoppage, and that work has since resumed. But they've faced so many challenges, and it's still considered a search and rescue effort, even though they have really not rescued anyone since the night of the collapse.
And Daniela, you reported for the Wall Street Journal that family members of the missing are starting to fear not just that their loved ones won't survive, but that their remains might not be found. Can you share a little bit of that reporting with us?
Yeah, I mean, as we've talked about, the search and rescue is so difficult, and there's tons and tons of concrete to sift through, the rains, the winds, the instability of the building. All of that is complicating the search and rescue. And there's this whole process of trying to identify the remains of those who, you know, fell in the collapse, and it's really harrowing for the families, because there's still that hope, right, that somebody survived. And like the prolongation of not knowing is just psychological torture in a way. And we as humans, we have rituals to mourn our dead and loved ones. And when you don't have that, it's really hard.
These are obviously, I mean, harrowing, difficult stories to report. For both of you, how do you find the balance between the need to document what's going on and also respecting the privacy and the terrible nature of what's happening with the people that are impacted? Joey?
It's very difficult, particularly when information begins to come out in the way that it does, right? Because people, there's a mass of people here, from elected officials to rescue workers, nearly 400 of them, supporting staff and volunteers. And of course, like, you start to hear about moments that occur, things that happen, or the recovery of bodies. And And that information, and you know, that information you have to confirm. You have to try to find out more. You want to be able to tell a whole story, but sometimes that's not really going to happen, because the rituals that we're talking about here on this show, that has to happen first. An example for we wrote a story this morning about a firefighter whose daughter was recovered last night, and he was on scene waiting for that to happen.
Of course,
and that's hard to write about.
It is. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both so much. Joey Fletchers with the Miami Herald, Daniela Hernandez with the Wall Street Journal. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. The show was produced by Andrea Perdomo and Jessica Bakeman with help from Kristen Moorhead. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations and show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mares. Richard Ives answers phones. I'm Danny Rivero. Thanks for calling and listening. Please take care of yourself, South Florida. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.